I'm calling this meeting to order of the Local Government and Housing Committee. The date is Wednesday, May 25th, and it is 9:41. With that, our first item on the agenda is roll call to determine the quorum. Maria, will you please call roll? Ms. Salding.
Here.
Mr. Friedrich.
Here.
Ms. Gustafson.
Here.
Ms. Hill. Ms. Novosel?
Here.
Mr. Rice?
Here.
Ms. Faustinos?
Here.
Mr. Lawrence?
Here.
And Ms. Hill? Madam Chair, we have a quorum.
Thank you.
And I did see
here.
There she is. Thought I saw you earlier. Thank you, Alexis. All right. Thank you so much. All right. With that, I'm going to go over the meeting rules for the day. For the members of the public who are joining us remotely, to observe the meeting, go to trpa.gov under the calendar heading. Click on the Governing Board Hybrid Meeting for May 25th, 2022. And there you will find a link to the public webinar hosted by Zoom. To address the committee members directly with your comments, please raise your hand in Zoom by clicking the Raise Your Hand at the bottom of your screen at the appropriate agenda item. With your hand raised, you will be unmuted by TRPA staff and have 3 minutes to address the committee. If you have used the dial-in numbers to join us by phone, you can dial *9 to raise your hand and be unmuted. To remote committee members, if you wish to speak, you can now raise your hand in Zoom. You will find the hand icon on the bottom of your screen. Remote committee members may not use the chat box to make any comments or to have any sidebar conversations. Please, everyone, remember to mute your mic unless you're speaking to cut down on the background noise. And finally, I would like to also ask that all remote members turn on their cameras if they are able to, so we can all see you. Members of the public who have joined us in person, please raise your hand at the appropriate time for public comment, and you will be called to the front to speak. Committee members who are in person, please raise your hand if you wish to comment or speak, and speak clearly into the microphone in front of you. If you are viewing the webinar on a personal computer, please ensure that your microphone and speakers are turned off to prevent audio feedback into the room. Okay, so with that, next item is approval of the agenda. So I'm going to ask staff, are there any changes to the agenda?
No changes to the agenda, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thank you. All right. Perfect. Then we will deem the agenda approved and amended for the record. Or not amended, just approved. Thank you. All right. Approval of the minutes. We now have on the agenda item 2, approval of the minutes. We have a set of minutes from January 6, 2021 on page 17 and from June 9th, 2021 on page 37. Do any members of the committee wish to make any changes? Seeing none, hearing none. If not, I'll entertain a motion to approve the minutes as presented.
So moved. Oh.
Okay, I think Cindy beat you in there, Alexis. So Cindy, thank you. With all those, now are we going to need to do a roll call? No, okay. All right. All those in favor say aye.
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 Any objections? Hearing none, that motion passes. Thank you. Okay, off to item number 3, appointment of the vice chair. I'm going to start this off by saying this is my last year on TRPA. I am termed out. So I think this is a good point right now to think about succession planning. And I've been kind of slowly doing that, is moving to the side. So at some point, we'll be talking about the chair position also. But today we have on our agenda the vice chair. And I would just ask if anybody would like to make a nomination. I do have someone I'd like to nominate, but if anyone else would like to make a nomination, then I would like to go ahead and nominate Alexis Hill to the vice chair. And Alexis, you can't speak at this moment. Alexis, <I'm> kidding. But you would like to say something, Lex. I'm just kidding. You're welcome to say something.
I would be honored to be the vice chair of this committee and learn from you, Sue, in your last term. And I think that this committee is incredibly important to the future of livability at Lake Tahoe. So thank you so much for thinking of me.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Do we have any other, ask again, any other nominations? Okay. Seeing none, then I will go to public comment on this first before we vote, I believe. Is that what we do? Yeah. Okay. All right. Then I'm going to go ahead and go to public comment. Mari, are there any public comments?
Madam Chair, there is no public comment on this item.
Okay. Are there any, is there anyone at Zoom that has raised their hand or dialed the star 9 that would like to speak?
Madam Chair, there is no further public comment.
Great. Well, then with that, we're going to close public comment. And any further comments from the committee? If not, I will entertain a motion to make a...
Madam Chairman, I move that Alexis Hill be elected by acclamation.
Perfect. All right. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Any opposed? Okay. With that, thank you. And welcome. Alexis, thank you so much. I really
thank
appreciate
you.
It. And I think we'll have an interesting time for the next 6 months or so.
We will.
Okay, thank you. All right. With that, we're going to go over to, I'm going to make pages here. Item number 4A, which is discussion and possible action recommendation of height density and coverage options to encourage affordable and workforce housing, including amendments to chapters 30, 31, and 37. So with that, I believe I'm going to pass it off to Karen Fink. Good morning, Karen.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Good morning, committee members. So I am just going to give a brief introduction. It's been about a year since we've met with the local government and housing committee. So we just wanted to start off with a review of some of the actions that TRPA has taken in that year related to housing, and also just point out some of the exciting things that the local governments have been doing as well related to affordable and workforce housing. And then I also want to just highlight how the Tahoe Living Working Group work kind of integrates with the committee, the governing board committee's work. So, and then I'll also just briefly describe the two agenda items that we're bringing to you today. So next slide, please. So in July of 2021, the governing board approved the phase one housing amendments. Also last year, the governing board approved an update to the VMT threshold, which included a provision related to affordable housing. So I've included basically the kind of new incentives that we have related to affordable housing in TRPA's regional plan now on this slide. So our policies now allow accessory dwelling units on all residential parcels on the California side. We've received actually 20 ADU applications since that code went into effect. And through those phase one housing amendments, the governing board also approved increases to residential densities when tourist development is undergoing a redevelopment project to residential. And now there's some significant fee waivers in place for affordable, moderate, and achievable housing. So for several years, we've had a fee waiver of our application fees. But last year, as part of the VMT threshold update, the governing board approved waiving the mobility mitigation fee for affordable, moderate, and achievable deed restricted housing. So that those two fees together can result in a waiver of about $3,000 to $10,000 in fees, which can be pretty significant, particularly for a smaller project like an ADU. Next slide, please. So there are many, many exciting things going on at the local level. All of you and your staffs have been really active implementing your housing elements and other housing actions. And this slide is not comprehensive at all, but I just kind of wanted to just briefly highlight some of, you know, a few innovative programs and projects that are happening. And I'm not even going to be able to touch on everything here, but I hope that we'll hear more details from each of you during your reports at the end of the meeting today. But, you know, the city of South Lake Tahoe was able to put quite a bit of general funds and were able to leverage significant state and federal grants for the Sugar Pine Village project. The Placer County has, I believe, made some updates yesterday to their workforce housing preservation program, which makes available first-time home buyer funding for local workers. Washoe County is getting going with their Washoe Tahoe Housing Partnership. Housing elements are getting approved. There's just a lot going on. So it's very exciting to see all of this and how all these different groups and agencies are working together. Next slide, please. So now I'm just going to give a quick overview of our items, the agenda items, before I turn it over to Alyssa, who will present the development standards, item 4A. So now we're in phase two of the Tahoe Living Housing and Community Revitalization Initiative. And what you're going to see today is kind of the main piece that the Tahoe Living Working Group and TRPA staff have been working on as part of that phase two. So the governing board appointed the Tahoe Living Working Group in January of 2021 as a committee of the APC. And really the purpose of that working group was to be able to have practitioners and people who really have experience working in the housing field who can provide direct input on how our existing policies are working, you know, what may be working or what doesn't work about them. And as we bring policy proposals forward, they can share their real world experience and let us know, you know, what they think will work and will not work. So the Tahoe Living Working Group is a 20 member group of stakeholders. We have affordable housing developers on the working group. We have builders, social service providers, representatives from our public lands agencies, environmental organizations. There's representatives from each of the local governments on the working group. We also have governing board representatives from this committee and from the regional plan implementation committee, and then other governing board members with an interest in or expertise in housing sometimes attend as well, such as Casey Beyer and now Vince Honigman. What we're bringing today is this kind of first set of concepts that we've vetted with the working group, received their input, and now we're bringing it to the local government and housing committee and the regional plan implementation committee for your input before we take it into the next phase, which would be the environmental analysis kind of process, and then bring it back with actual code amendments for recommendations for approval and approvals. So, the focus of this phase is really to continue to look at ways that we can better implement the land use pattern that was envisioned in the regional plan so that we can, you know, provide those support transit and walkable communities, reduce greenhouse gas emissions and help achieve our climate goals, as well as achieving the affordable housing goals in the regional plan and that our local government's affordable housing targets. So Alyssa is going to present on those concepts. She's also going to present the results of the work of our consultant Cascadia Partners, who did a financial feasibility analysis on these policies. And then after that, I will give an update on some changes that we're proposing to our achievable definition. So with that, I'll turn it over to Alyssa, who is here on Zoom.
Thank you, Karen. And just want to confirm that everyone can hear me.
Yes,
great. We're good. Thank you. Good morning, everyone. Alyssa Bettinger with TRPA. Thank you for the intro, Karen. So we're going to do this in kind of a two-part presentation. So first, I'm going to present the results of a pro forma analysis that our consultants Cascadia did for us back in the fall. And then I will move into our proposal for how to address some of these things that came out in the analysis. Next slide, please. So specifically, we asked Cascadia, which is a real estate, land use, and housing firm that's based out of Portland, to look at or to explore the feasibility of building more workforce housing through testing some alternative development standards for both TRPA standards. So in this analysis, we were looking at density, coverage, and height, and then also to highlight other constraints that we haven't talked in as much detail about. Next slide, please. So the analysis looked at three different scenarios. The first, what it would take to build a duplex on a 5,000 square foot lot in the Kings Beach residential subdistrict up in Placer County. And we used a 5,000 square foot lot because we found that that is the median size of a lot that is already zoned for multifamily in the basin. So by using this size of a parcel in this analysis, we can sort of more broadly apply these results throughout the region, not just focusing specifically on Placer County. Next slide. The next scenario looked at what it would take to build a fourplex on a slightly larger parcel at 8,000 square feet in the Incline Village residential area. This is outside of the town center, so not all of the highest development standard incentives exist. And we found that the findings in this zone were very similar to the first scenario in Kings Beach. So I'm not going to go into those today, but we did include the full results in your packet, and the full results can also be found on our website. Next slide, please. And then the last scenario looked at building a multi-unit affordable development on a 12,000 square foot parcel within the city's Ski Run Boulevard Town Center. So this is a little bit different of a scenario because it does provide that the town center areas do provide for that those higher development standards. And so I'll go into this in a few minutes. Next slide, please. So I think we will just dive right into the first scenario. Again, this is looking at the Kings Beach residential subdistrict up in Placer County. Next slide. So even though Kings Beach residential primarily consists of single family homes right now, the statement of purpose in the zone is that the Kings Beach residential area is anticipated to have a mixed residential use type. So you can see in the graphic on the bottom of this slide, you know, we're really trying to encourage a mix of residential housing types in this zone. And this opens up the opportunity to explore what it means to build more than just a single family home in this area, and specifically building housing types that are known to be more affordable than single family homes, such as middle housing types. Next slide, please. So for scenario one, Cascadia again modeled a duplex on a 5,000 square foot lot. And the intent of this scenario is to understand how the existing code impacts duplex development and test out some alternative development standards that might help further support duplex development in this specific area. Next slide. Here is a quick summary of existing standards compared to the alternative test standards that we used. The alternative test standards are shown in blue. You can see in the middle column that the current allowable density is 15 units per acre. In this scenario, we asked them to go up to 20 units per acre and explore how the feasibility changes. The maximum height in this area is 3 stories. We asked them to go up to 3.5 stories. And then the maximum lot coverage right now, we assumed that this is a high capability, relatively flat parcel. And so the max allowable coverage could go up to 30%. And then alternatively, we asked them to test what it would look like how would the feasibility change if we went up to 70% coverage. We've also included setback and parking requirements in this table just for reference, although these are primarily implemented at the local government level. Again, this is not in one of our town centers where we want to see kind of the highest growth, but is in our highest density multifamily areas outside of town centers. Next slide, please. And our first big finding of modeling a duplex under existing code is that you can't actually build anything. You run into a no-build scenario. And if you look at the units per acre calculation, 2 units on a 5,000 square foot lot actually exceeds the density allowance of 15 units per acre in this zone. And so 15 units per acre doesn't actually equate to 15 units per parcel. It's, you have to do that calculation, which you see on this slide, to identify how many actual units you can have on the property. And in this case, in order to get 2 units on a 5,000 square foot lot, you would need at least 17 and a half units per acre density allowance to do that. But we didn't want to end the test there. We wanted to explore how other development standards might impact the duplex development as well. So assuming that we increase maximum density to allow a duplex, we wanted to know what was the next biggest obstacle that we ran into. Next slide, please. Well, you pretty much run into lot coverage. We found that 30% lot coverage maximums are kind of a major barrier because it does make for an awkward and inefficient duplex. You can see here that 909 square feet is the maximum unit size with 30% coverage. And there's a couple of reasons that we can't build larger units. One is because of parking. Space for parking goes towards the maximum amount of coverage, and it really eats into the space that you have for the overall living, for the overall living space. In this case, Cascadia included garages, which essentially take up pretty much the entire first floor of the development, which leaves, you know, not a lot of space for the rest of the actual living space. Additionally, although you're allowed 3 stories, the roof pitch requirements limit livable square footage on the third floor. So you can see that on this top floor, you know, the slant, there's only a certain amount of space that is actually, you know, livable within that top floor. And so this further limits the amount of maximum square footage that you could have access to. And so essentially our takeaway was that you're left with small duplex units, and typically they're too small to be family size, and they're definitely too small to be market feasible. Next slide. Our financial analysis shows a rate on investment comes in the negatives, which is definitely far off from the target rate of around 12 to 15% that developers typically like to see. The minimum amount you would need to sell this duplex for is about 19% over current market trends. And so overall, due to the size and financial performance, this duplex really isn't something that a developer would be interested in building, which is why we don't see many new duplexes going in Kings Beach, or really in a lot of our multifamily zones throughout the basin. Next slide. Another finding from Cascadia's analysis was that setbacks and lot coverage result in a very different buildable area. You can see in this graphic here that setbacks take up about 44% of the site, which leaves about 66% to be buildable. Alternatively, coverage standards at 30%, more than half of the buildable area is left vacant. And this is important to note because this this area that is left vacant has a dollar amount, and that dollar amount is almost $52,000 in land costs. So here we're kind of observing, or Cascadia observed, a misalignment between coverage and setback standards, and it is important to note that it does have a cost. Next slide. So finally, to put a fine point on what is technically allowed under the existing code doesn't always align with development standards. So you can see here in the bottom graphic, the area or the housing types that are shown in red are technically allowed, but the single family home is typically the most actual feasible housing type in this area. Next slide. So how does a duplex under existing code compare with a duplex under recommended alternative standards? Well, for one, you can build a lot more comfortable duplex by increasing the lot coverage standards. It gives us a little bit of wiggle room to include bigger units and make this duplex a lot more feasible. I also want to highlight here that you'll see under building and parking coverage, just from going from 30 to 34% does actually allow for quite a significant increase in units, which makes the development actually more feasible. It's, you know, just having a few extra square feet makes the units more family size and just more comfortable. And it also improves the rate of return on investment. So we went from negative 3.1% under alternative standards to 7.5%. And while this doesn't quite reach our target, it significantly improves. And you can also see that with a minimum feasible sale price, it was 19% above market rate, and now it's 7% above market rate. So, you know, while we're still not quite hitting our targets, we're getting closer. Next slide, please. And just to highlight here with a couple of graphics, alternative test standards do comfortably accommodate a duplex with an average 3-bedroom unit size and does indeed improve the rate of return. Next slide. So as part of the analysis, we wanted to test how current development standards affect the feasibility of multifamily housing. And can you go to the next slide? Perfect, thanks. And so you saw that, you know, the first thing that we ran into was the maximum density just doesn't allow for the feasibility to build a duplex. Next slide, please. And then assuming increases to density, the 30% lot coverage does still create kind of an awkward and inefficient layout. And so, it's really not super feasible to build more than a large single family unit or a very small duplex. Next slide, please. Assuming increases to density and lot coverage, setbacks do consume close to half of the site, limiting development to no more than a triplex. Next slide, please. And assuming increases to density and buildable area, the parking requirements do severely limit the potential for denser housing, just because the parking requirements for multifamily and single family are the same. Next slide. And then last, we run into height. The 36-foot maximum height starts to become a significant barrier when you're building slightly larger multifamily. So in this case, at 6 units and beyond. But again, going back to that roof pitch requirement, you know, that it's not necessarily the height that's limiting, but it's the amount of usable space on the top story with that roof pitch requirement. Next slide, please. So this is scenario 3. And again, I just want to reiterate that we did skip scenario 2 up in Incline Village, just because it came out with very similar results to the Kings Beach scenario. That the Incline scenario is included in your packet if you would like to take a look. Next slide, please. So Ski Run Boulevard is located in the tourist core, and it is a town center. It has a variety of amenities, services, transit, and also a few bike paths that come into this area. And really do, and this area really does support a wide range of mixed uses, of which includes multifamily residential. And because of because this area is in close proximity to a lot of these amenities and uses, Ski Run is identified as a preferred affordable housing area. Next slide. So we thought it would be interesting as part of this process to model a multi-unit deed-restricted affordable development. So this is a little different than the last scenario in that we're specifically looking at a fully deed-restricted development. So similar to what we're looking at like with Sugar Pine in the South Shore. Whereas in scenario 1, it was not deed restricted. We're using 12,000 square feet as the parcel size. We did find that the median size of vacant lots in the Ski Run Boulevard area is about 12,000 square feet. And let's see, next slide, please. And again, here's a quick summary table of existing standards versus test standards in blue. And because this is in a town center and we already have some incentives for maximum height and coverage allowances, we allow higher height and coverage in town centers already. We allow a little bit higher density as well at 25 units per acre. But in this scenario, we wanted to increase this up to 40 units per acre to see how that impacts the feasibility. Next slide. So under the existing code, you can build up to 6 units. This is based on that 25 units per acre. It's a pretty simple density calculation. And we're using 770 square feet as the average size of a unit. We did find that this is a pretty typical unit size for an affordable development. The building and parking coverage come in at about 34% coverage. And this does take into account the parking reduction that the city offers for affordable housing development. The subsidy required per unit we found is about $375,000 per unit. So in order to make this project work, that would be the cost per unit. Next slide, please. And a couple of findings here. We learned that the maximum density is essentially holding you back from the other development opportunities that other standards have to offer. And so because building and parking only covers 34% of the lot, less than half of the coverage allowed under existing standards is actually utilized. And although the existing code allows for up to 4 stories, a 6-unit development we found in this case doesn't actually require more than 3.5 stories. So this is just to say that other standards are offering a lot more in this specific town center area. And maximum density is kind of the only thing that is hindering the development potential on this lot. Next slide. And again, setbacks and lot coverage result in different buildable areas. So there's sort of a misalignment between these two standards. In this case, it's actually opposite from the previous scenario in that setbacks are actually consuming more of the lot than the 70% allowable coverage. And so Cascadia found that these standards are sort of taking turns in defining the buildable areas. Next slide. So how does what we can build under existing code compare with what we can build if we do increase maximum density? And so this slide is showing a pretty simple math question. Again, we're just doing a calculation to see how many more units we can get and how does that impact the feasibility of this development. So we're seeing an increase from 6 to 11 units, which is almost double. And we are keeping the same unit size for comparison. You can see that the building and parking coverage increases pretty drastically, so from 34% to 56%. And at the bottom, most importantly, you can see that the subsidy needed per unit does decrease. And we know that subsidies in affordable housing are scarce and oftentimes very competitive. So even though it is only a 10.5% reduction in the subsidy needed per unit, it could, you know, kind of tip the scale to make this project go from infeasible to feasible. So it's not insignificant. Next slide. Again, so what we learned is that increasing maximum density can help decrease the amount of funding required to subsidize deed-restricted affordable units. And this is a pretty significant finding when it comes to just increasing max density in this zone. Again, because while we have higher allowances for height and coverage, our density is sort of holding us back in this situation. And while this does include parking reductions for affordable housing, again, the city does offer these parking reductions for deed-restricted affordable housing. About 33% of the lot is used up by parking. So you can go to the next slide. Great. And so it's important to sort of test and understand the impact of parking reductions in order to calibrate them in a way that supports affordable housing development. Next slide. And next slide. Thanks. So again, just to highlight kind of the key steps here, maximum density limits development to no more than 6 units. 6 units is great, but if we could have more and better utilize the incentives that we have for other development standards, why not do that? Next slide, please. Assuming increases in density, setbacks, again, are kind of the next place that we bump into. And they consume about 43% of the site, which is more than the coverage allowances do in this zone. Next slide. Again, parking requirements are, remain a significant barrier and limits the development to no more than 13 units unless parking reductions were decreased. Assuming increases to density and lower parking minimums, maximum height and lot coverage do become a significant barrier at more than 20 units. Next slide, please. So Cascadia's kind of 3 big takeaways for us. One, there's no single silver bullet. We saw in all of these scenarios that we can't just change one standard and make a large impact. And the perfect example of this is density. Just by increasing density, it's not enough. We'll run into other standards. And so they really go hand in hand. And it's important to think big picture about how we can address these all together. The second was that barriers to multifamily development increase with density. And this might be sort of a given, but we have a lot of standards in the basin that are very friendly to single family development, but become very significant barriers with building multifamily. So for example, in the last, in the ski run scenario, you saw that the parking requirements, they take up so much of the lot. So how can we kind of better calibrate those to reflect what we want to see? And then third, changing development standards is a relatively hard process. It takes a lot of political will. It involves talking to a lot of people and going to a lot of committees. And so change is hard. And so Cascadia recommended that we should tackle the development standards that we see could have the largest impact in terms of breaking down barriers. Next slide, please. So that concludes Cascadia's analysis. And I know that was a lot of information to throw at you, but I do want to just roll into TRPA's presentation, and then we can take questions on all of this at the very end.
I'm sorry, I thought we were moving back over to you.
Or? Oh, no, Alyssa's going to continue with the rest of the
presentation. Sorry, go ahead.
Yep, I'm going to keep rolling with it. All right, so as you saw in the analysis, the development standards implemented at both the TRPA and local jurisdiction level really influence and ultimately dictate what gets built in the basin. And the analysis showed us that for most of the areas in the basin, it is a lot easier to build single family homes than it is to build the multifamily types that our workforce really relies on. Throughout the past year, our housing team has been focused on developing options that open doors for solutions to a number of big regional plan goals. And among these are encouraging workforce housing development, but we also want to better connect our housing and transportation network. We want to create walkable communities that are close to services, amenities, and transit. And we really want to concentrate development in our centers. And advancing on all of these goals really does help positively impact our climate and sustainability of Tahoe. And so today we are here, as Karen mentioned, to present some conceptual policy options related to how we can address height, density, and coverage to kind of further get at some of those goals. So this summer, as Karen already did mention, we'll be moving these options through the environmental analysis. So the purpose of presenting these to you today is to get your input on what should be included in this package for further analysis. Next slide. So we'll start with density. Because this was, you know, kind of a key standard that was identified in the Cascadia analysis, we wanted to start here. Again, density is implemented by allowing certain units per acre. So it's sort of the standard that controls the number of units you can place on a lot depending on how big the parcel is. Many parcels that are smaller and closer to town centers can have more than, or can't have more than one unit just because they're too small. So in that first example, you saw that you couldn't even build a duplex under existing density standards. And by using relatively low density standards paired with a lot of smaller parcels in the basin, we really are inadvertently excluding the missing middle types, the missing middle housing types like duplexes and triplexes and fourplexes that are often sort of affordable by design types that were highlighted in the OptGhost presentation at Local Government Housing Committee last year. And as a result of this, many of the parcels in the basin that are zoned for multifamily either end up being developed as a single family home or often just remain as vacant lots. And so our proposal also focuses on town centers today, where existing densities are currently 25 units per acre. And we're finding that this is generally just not high enough to support the transit and walkable development that we want to see. And then you also saw in the second scenario in the analysis that even at 25 units per acre, density constrains the development opportunities that increased coverage in heightened town centers can offer. Next slide, please. So our first conceptual proposal would allow a minimum of 3 units or a triplex on any parcel that is already zoned for multifamily housing in the basin. And that would be regardless of the existing units per acre standard or size of the parcel. This incentive, as we're bringing it forward today, would be only for deed restricted units. So that would be deed restricted, affordable, moderate, or achievable. And this would apply in areas that are already zoned for multifamily. So that's shown in the areas in purple on the screen. In these areas, current densities range from about 8 units all the way up to 25 units per acre in our town centers. And so again, this proposal would allow up or a minimum of 3 units, regardless of whether they could get those 3 units with existing density allowances. Next slide, please. In addition to the analysis highlighting the need for increased density in town centers, we've also received a few comments encouraging us to look at increasing density in our quote unquote downtown and surrounding areas through this process. Town center densities, again, at 25 units per acre are too low to support the type of development that we want to see in these areas. For reference, densities for tourist uses go up to about 40 units per acre in a lot of these areas. So we would like to use 40 units per acre as sort of a starting point for looking at residential densities in this area. And we are open to the idea of going even higher if the analysis shows that that is needed. I do want to note that this is not the first time we've increased densities up or above 25 units per acre. Back in 2010, we did amend our code to allow for up to 30 units per acre for affordable housing projects up in Kings Beach. And so we've done this before. There's precedent for this. This option would also allow the local local governments to sort of decide if they want to utilize this increased density. So we would be increasing regional plan densities in these specific areas, but it would be implemented at the local jurisdiction level through their area plan. So not every area we realize is appropriate for higher density. So this would give the local government sort of that control to decide where where that increased density is most appropriate. And in terms of applicability, we would like to analyze this higher density option for developments that are building a certain percentage of deed-restricted housing. So this option is a little different than some of the other options that we're bringing forward today in that this wouldn't be for 100% deed-restricted developments. It would be for a development that, say, is 75% market rate and they're setting aside 25% of the units for deed-restricted, affordable, moderate, or achievable. Next slide, please. The next development standard that Cascadia identified in their analysis was coverage. Coverage or impervious surface can often prevent the infiltration and treatment of water and stormwater runoff, which leads to water quality impacts in the lake. Coverage also contributes to soil erosion and limits vegetation growth. And these are all reasons why TRPA regulates the amount of coverage that can be built on a lot. And this is based on the land use classification system that looks at how much development lands in the basin can tolerate. Higher capability lands can obviously tolerate more development, more severe disturbances, and remain pretty stable. Other more sensitive areas like SEZs and also steep slopes can become pretty highly unstable after just a bit of development or a slight disturbance. In the past, the agency has recognized that coverage limitations impact our development objectives in the basin. And as a result, we have put in place incentives to encourage development that helps us meet our regional plan goals. So for example, the higher coverage and height allowances in our town centers, that's a great example of when, we've provided examples when we've provided incentives to help meet our regional plan goals. Next slide. And through the working group process and further reinforced by the Cascadia analysis, we do know that our current coverage system, it does encourage single family over multifamily because coverage allowances are the same to build both right now, even though typically more coverage is needed for multifamily. We've also heard that in our town centers where higher coverage is already allowed, that it can be pretty difficult to find and transfer in. So even though you can go up to 70% coverage in town centers, you still have to transfer that coverage in, which does, there is a cost associated with that. And then outside of town centers, a lot of parcels that are pretty suitable for workforce housing exist just outside of these town center boundaries. So you can see on this slide, the Ski Run Boulevard Town Center, there are it's relatively small and there are quite a few parcels that are just adjacent to this boundary that hold a lot of our more dense development right now. And a lot of existing or, pseudo affordable housing exists in this area right now. And so if we want compact development close to centers, we do need to identify alternative ways of looking at coverage for workforce housing that maintains the same level of water quality and soil protection, but also allows more flexibility on coverage limits for specific workforce housing types. So based on these objectives, we've put together the following two options that we would like to hear from you on today. Next slide. The first option would allow property owners to build above base allowable coverage up to a maximum of 70%, so similar to town centers, for deed-restricted multifamily or ADUs outside of town centers. This additional coverage would be available for the deed-restricted unit only, and it would be a maximum of 70% coverage. So an example of this is if someone wanted to build an ADU, if they're already at their maximum amount of coverage, they could build this ADU and increase their coverage to do that. Pointing back to the Cascadia analysis, it did show that only about 34% of coverage would be needed for a duplex, And in scenario two, in the Incline Village, it showed that 42% of coverage would be needed for a fourplex. So while we would be allowing up to 70%, it's not every case that 70% would be needed. Similar to our existing town center, incentives, this would be limited to high capability lands, and would require that BMPs be installed to treat the runoff from any additional coverage that's put on the property. And we do anticipate that these units would primarily be located in the bonus unit boundary, because again, this incentive would be for deed restricted housing only, and the cost associated with obtaining a development right is pretty high, and there's a limited amount of them. Anytime we do allow additional coverage over what we call base allowable, it needs to be mitigated through transferring in coverage. And so while this option does give flexibility in terms of the overall coverage limits, we know that transferring in coverage can be hard to find, and it also can be costly. And so essentially with this option, we're allowing more coverage, but there's still sort of a high cost associated with that. And so through the environmental analysis, we would like to look at whether there are any alternative mitigation strategies that could help applicants find coverage or alleviate some of these costs associated with transfer requirements. Next slide, please. The second option would take an alternative approach to water quality and soil protection specifically for deed restricted housing. We would like to look holistically at water quality, soils, and coverage kind of together, and use some of the more advanced technology that we have available to us today with this option. We have a lot of GIS data right now that can help us identify sort of a broader range of land constraints, such as erosion or high groundwater, and sensitive areas that should be considered with development or redevelopment. And in most other areas outside of the basin, this data is paired with stormwater management regulations and putting green stormwater infrastructure systems in place to provide sort of a more modern alternative to water quality and soil protection. Due to the basin's history and sort of the way that it was developed, we don't have a lot of this stormwater infrastructure already in place. But by looking at sort of this alternative approach to coverage in a very limited capacity for specifically workforce housing, we could see some environmentally beneficial redevelopment while implementing, at the same time, multiple provisions and getting at those goals of our regional plan. We would like to test this option in more urban areas, specifically in areas that would be appropriate for workforce housing. And this would require a strong partnership with the local jurisdictions or a similar entity. Oftentimes there are general improvement districts in Nevada that we would like to work with to sort of work out what this would look like. Next slide, please. All right, and the last development standard that Cascadia identified in their analysis was height. And current TRPA height standards encourage residential development that blends in and is compatible with surrounding uses and the environment. The analysis did show that height is not as much of a concern as some of the other standards, and that specifically increasing height from 3 to 3.5 stories has, relatively little effect on the feasibility for smaller scale multifamily projects, so for that duplex. This is consistent with what, in general, we've heard from the Tahoe Living Working Group and at our meetings with local jurisdiction staff. We know that, height is not so much of an issue when you're building smaller scale multifamily, but when you get into the larger, like 20 plus unit multifamily developments, it does become more of a challenge. Next slide, please. You can go back one. Thank you. So the height chapter of the code currently outlines maximum height for buildings using the percent slope retained across a building site and the specified roof pitch. And the intent of regulating roof pitch is that the resulting building will be attractive and compatible with surrounding uses. We did see in the Cascadia analysis that the existing roof pitch requirements really does limit the amount of usable space on the top floor. And we also know that in addition to just creating an inefficient building, it also doesn't accommodate the energy efficiency needs to create more sustainable developments. And it doesn't really meet modern design standards. We're seeing a lot of, project applicants come in for area plan amendments, trying to allow for a more flexible roof pitch. And so by doing this, we would better utilize, we wouldn't need to change our height allowances, but we would just better utilize the height that already exists. We also wouldn't compromise neighborhood character by increasing allowable height. This is the main proposal that we'd like your feedback on today. And you can go to the next slide. So just to sort of tie all of this together, we've heard the need for greater flexibility in town centers, potentially above what is already allowed and what we're proposing today even. So the flexibility that's needed is really dependent on the parcel, and it's sort of difficult to put in place these blanket incentives that might not work in every case. So really to help address this, we would like to explore the option of, again, partnering with local governments to implement some pilot programs that could combine some of the TRPA development standard incentives with flexibility from the local jurisdictions on their standards. In our meetings with local government staff, we did talk about certain areas where higher density coverage height, reduced parking, and potentially setbacks could be appropriate, like in the tourist core. And these areas would definitely need to be near transit services and larger employment centers, and could be an opportunity to sort of introduce even more flexible development standards than what we're proposing today. Next slide, please. So we did present these concepts to the Tahoe Living Working Group back in the end of March, and we've incorporated their feedback into what we presented today. Again, we do want your input on which of these concepts we should move forward with, and if there are any concepts or components that we should be adding to this list or potentially deleting. Following this meeting, we will be going to RPIC next month to further refine these concepts, again, before beginning the environmental analysis and code amendments this summer. Next slide, please. So with that, Sue, I will pass it back to you for further discussion.
Thank you, Alyssa, and thank you, Karen. That was a lot of information. And understanding our time, I think we're a little limited, but certainly want to make sure we get all comments from our committee members first and then go to the public and try to abbreviate as much as we can, understanding we're kind of limited, but that was great information. Thank you. A lot of work. So I'll start with City Hall. Go around.
Sure.
Thank you.
Well, I support looking at all these options. Obviously we have a housing crisis and a lot of barriers to it. I know, again, just reflecting on some of the other efforts we're making mm-hmm. countywide, we continue to look at SB 9 and the implications of SB 9 and using only a 1,200 square foot lot from minimum. That's a California Senate Bill 9, and really reducing those requirements and so that we can get secondary units with restrictions. And whether that's a deed restriction or type of use restriction. And I do like the ideas that there's other ways to address stormwater management requirements to protect our environment and make those changes. So I look forward to both the pilots and the options that you've talked about.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. First, I just want to put out there, I mean, it's been a long process, and I have really thoroughly enjoyed in a weird way being part of it and being part of all of those meetings. I have learned so much from the local government representatives about the challenges. And Sue, thank you for your leadership on the committee. And then also I can't resist that I'm very happy that my Washoe County commissioner is going to be in a leadership role here for the local government committee. So it's weird talking this way and having faces behind me. Anyway, just a couple of comments. One, I actually, Cindy answered my question. I was curious regarding the setback standards that came up as a barrier. I couldn't figure out whether those were TRPA setback standards or local government setback standards, and was assuming local, but thanks for clarifying that. And I support all of the options as well to be explored. I think what's in the back of my mind, I would love to see every single barrier lifted and get as much affordable housing as possible. But we also are an environmental agency protecting the health of the basin. And I'm very mindful that we have a regional plan that's based on an environmental document with restrictions regarding development capacity, how we use allocations and land coverage restrictions. And our environmental document is hanging on a lot of those restrictions. So I do think we need to be cautious. It's not as easy as just saying, oh, well, let's just increase coverage. I do think we need to look at it, but I think there needs to be a very, very strict look on how it ties to the environmental document that supported the regional plan update. I think green stormwater, I'd be curious to learn more. I know from a state of Nevada perspective, we have funded a lot of road projects between NDOT and local governments. And so I'm not be curious on how this is above and beyond what is existing in order to get that, sort of variance or whatever. But I do think it needs to be looked at. So thank you for the presentation and all the great work.
Thank you. Belinda.
Well, again, I'll just reiterate, it's been fantastic to be part of this process and working with local government it has to deal with these issues on a day-to-day basis is pretty significant. And I would just, really offer that, making sure that there is good public engagement as part of this process, because frankly, local government are the ones that are going to have to deal with these issues. And so to the extent that, as we find out more about where these opportunities exist, to make sure that there's extensive public engagement so that, we can mitigate some of the feedback, that negative feedback we might be getting. So that's all.
Great comments. Thank you. Mark, did you want to say something or you're not really? Okay. On to Wes.
First of all, it's good to see you all in the flesh. It's been too long. This is something we've been grappling with on the Nevada side for quite a while. I have been a proponent of affordable housing for a while, sometimes to my chagrin, but depending upon who I'm talking to today. But this is necessary. We have to do something, but I really want us to be mindful that we don't overcorrect ourselves, so that we actually impede the progress that this agency has made over the years. I shouldn't say this in public, but I shared this with Joanne a couple of weeks ago. When we moved here 31 years ago, TRPA did not stand for Tahoe Regional Planning Agency. It was a little rougher than that, but you know what I mean. Anyway, this organization made great strides in protecting the lake. And I've heard criticism that we should concentrate on the lake and don't worry about social engineering, which in fact, this is social engineering. And is that our role? I want to be mindful of that as well. And we need to move forward. We need to do something. But I just want to make sure that we tread carefully.
Great comment. Thank you. And so I'm going to go ahead and take it off to the rest of our committee members first, which would be the online members. And for Sissy Shelley, Shelley, do you have any comments?
Thank you, Sue. You know, I'm a little embarrassed. Here I am in Carson City, 30 minutes away from the lake, and I'm not joining you. And I just, it's not because I don't like you. Rest assured, it's just because my husband is COVID positive, and I thought I'd spare you exposing myself to any of you in that way. So, you know, I certainly agree with what both Jim and Wes have said. I mean, everything we do, you know, is kind of a delicate balancing act. And but I do support investigating these various options. And I think pilot programs are important in order to inform the general public about what the ultimate impacts of our decisions might be, for preventing them with providing them with visual aids and real life examples of, you know, what can be done to address the affordable housing issue while still protecting the lake and adhering to our environmental standards. I did have one question, I guess, for Alyssa on page 291 of our governing board packet. You know, and you alluded to it in your presentation as well, you know, going from 25 units per acre to 40 units per acre, that's a 62% increase. I think 20% is a pretty modest percentage of the units that should be deed restricted. Now, I understand, again, it's a delicate balancing act with respect to making these projects financially feasible. But I think to the greatest extent possible, if we're going to make some fairly substantial concessions here, I think we need to, you know, be as aggressive as possible with respect to the number of units that need to be deed restricted in these various projects, since we're giving the developer a fairly substantial incentive. And then, you know, I understand, looking at the rec building that we recently approved in South Lake Tahoe, I mean, that's institutional use, in my opinion. And I would hate to see homes or multifamily units look institutional. I think that, you know, we have to also, in addition to respecting the environment at Lake Tahoe, we have to respect, I think, to the extent we can, the architectural history of the area as well. So while diminishing the pitch, you know, is probably, you know, it's not going to be, there are not going to be A-frames, obviously, but, you know, making some concessions on pitch is appropriate. But I would hate to see, you know, duplexes and triplexes with flat roofs. You also have to take into consideration snow loading from a practical standpoint. I understand our winters haven't been as heavy as they have been in the past, but who knows, that might change. So I think going through this process and evaluating all of these options, looking at the pros and the cons, the benefits and the disadvantages is important. So I would encourage you to press forward.
Thank you, Shelley. Alexis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am also excited about what these options will look like. For me, in working with developers over the last year and a half as a commissioner, they really need clear standards that everyone understands. And so I do have a little bit of a concern about a pilot project because I feel like that could create confusion. And I feel like in Washoe Tahoe, we still have staff getting, you know, up on our area plan changes. And I just want to make sure that we can help people through this process to understand what they can do so they don't get frustrated and build something that wouldn't, you know, eventually benefit the working families that we really need to live up at Lake Tahoe to run all of our different businesses and work in the community. So that is my only concern. I just really want to see clarity, and that's why on coverage, the coverage number two, the soil protection measures, I want to make sure that we understand, you know, staff would understand how that would be implemented, and it's clear for developers to understand moving forward. And so I agree, we have to balance lake clarity and environmental issues. And I think that TRPA has done that and will continue to do that. This is just a way to ensure that we can have functioning businesses up in our communities, because it is that much of an emergency. Up in Klein Village and Crystal Bay, we're having some major issues staffing restaurants. They're not even open 7 days a week. I think that, you know, this is an emergency, and figuring out that balance. I think I've heard from staff that they're really doing a good job of doing that. So can't wait to hear what those outcomes are. And thank you for your work on this.
Thank you, Alexis. John.
There we go. First of all, thanks to Alyssa and Karen for a very thorough and thoughtful presentation. I thought you were
John, you're a little quiet. Can you turn that up a little bit, if you can? Sorry.
Maybe is it a better little... now?
How's this? That's better. That's better. Thank you.
Okay. And make adjustment. All right. So, yeah, thank you to Alyssa and Karen for a very thoughtful presentation, and covered a lot of material. I support studying all these elements. I also do support pilot programs as well. I know the Workforce Housing Group was very supportive of pilots, and that's how you get information and test it in real world conditions. I would say I don't see this as social engineering. I see this as planning based on priorities, and that's what the agency is all about, making choices. And to that extent, to my colleagues' concerns about environmental impact, I think that's perhaps you could add to the analysis opportunities to look at trade-offs. So, for example, as you know, we have a housing crisis on one hand, and we also have a proliferation of vacation rentals in our neighborhoods on the other. Could we be taking a new look at requiring TAUs for vacation rentals? Stronger part if density is a concern with more people living in new affordable housing developments, could we, you know, look at stronger parking management strategies or other ways to mitigate increased traffic impacts in other ways, or disincentives for large single family monster homes, especially say close to the lake, in Howard's based on our fee structures. So I would just say, to the extent we can meet this critical housing need in a way that also protects the lake, might require looking at some of those kind of trade-offs. Perhaps we need to look at where we're subtracting while we're adding, so that we make sure we're not having a greater lake impact. And I think that may be a way to, you know, kind of have our cake and eat it too, although that will, you know, that won't make all constituencies happy, but we have to make, again, you know, choices and policy priorities. And that's, again, not social engineering. That's just planning based on what are the top priorities and how do we balance those various competing interests. So thank you.
Thank you. And thank you to all the committee members for those comments. Really great comments and so much work. I was so impressed when I looked at this item, so excited about the thought of where we could go next, being that we are all doing this in our local jurisdictions, is talking about how in the world, as was the comment from Alexis, we can't get proper staffing right now. This is an emergency issue right now for our local communities and as workforce housing. So incredibly important work. And I thank staff, like I said, just to go back over it and see that this is going to be coming back for more information, and that, the possibility of a pilot program, I think, sounds great. I had a couple quick comments and then we'll go to public comment, if that's okay. I was looking at, at my district, of course, El Dorado County, and we don't have a very big town center area, and there's frankly no residential building right now within it. But close to it, as was mentioned at one point, we do have some areas where we have multi-family dwellings, and so I'm just wondering if we could take a look at that possibility that you mentioned is something near, X amount of miles, whether it's a mile or two. We don't have any transit out there at our town center, so that's another impact for us. Just a couple, like I said, quick impacts from El Dorado County specifically, but something to look at would be near the town centers, if there was a way to incorporate that where that made sense within those areas. Perhaps a pilot program where it's nearer, I think might be interesting. For the other part, somebody brought up the idea of increasing coverage and how that could affect our plan. And I agree. But I look back, I don't know why it is, but when I was in Boulder, Colorado 1 year, and I was so impressed by the fact that they have such a great plan and that they have urbanized areas, dwellings, multifamily dwellings, and this goes for a lot of Colorado, within a dense area. And then on the outside, they have these incredible open space green areas. I'm wondering if there's a way we can have a conversation about mitigating more density with more open space around it, green space around it. Perhaps that is the conversation that will help get us to where we need to get environmentally to understand if that makes sense for us. And, you know, I don't know if that's even possible, but I'm hoping it's something we can look at. And then the third part was the discussion about using other development rights, such as TAUs, to offset some of these coverage issues and all that. I know it's way above my pay grade understanding how that works, but I think there's maybe a possibility of doing some transfers there, and that would help. I know Sugar Pine had some issues with that, trying to get coverage, and if there was a way to balance that out through development rights, perhaps that's something we can look at too. I think you have been looking at it, but just throw that out there. So that was just my comments. Again, just very impressed with all of our comments and appreciate it. It's something we really need to keep working on. I'm really happy that we're back together and having this discussion. So don't want to belabor it more, and we're getting late. So I thought maybe probably good to go to public comment unless there's any other comments from any. I don't see any. So let's go to public comment. If any member of the public wishes to address the local government and housing committee at this time, please raise your hand now, either in person or by clicking the raise hand button at the bottom of your Zoom screen. Or by dialing *9 on your phone, and you'll be called on and unmuted by a TRPA staff member. Okay. Mari, are there any public comments out there?
Thank you, Madam Chair. We do have some public comments. First is a caller. I don't have a name. If your number ends in 8834, please go ahead and address the committee.
Good morning. This is Carol Black, Incline Village resident. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can, Carol. Yes.
Okay, thanks. This was an impressive, awesome presentation. I wondered if the slides can be made available, if they aren't already, and I just didn't find them. And I just had a couple of very quick comments. I think you have remembered, but I want to emphasize that to remember that all Tahoe area town centers and nearby are not equal in terms of size, accessibility, environment issues, et cetera. And in addition to the local government regulation overlay that you mentioned, to also consider recognizing in TRPA processes and regs some of these differences, as you have in this presentation. Just a side note, in Incline Village, I could list possible issues, but I will just dwell on one. Please don't forget parking. We have limited on street availability and very limited parking capability on the lot. So just to make that point. Also, want to be sure that none of these changes, and I don't think they do, undermine the STR lot restriction Nevada exception that's still in place. Because right now, I do not believe that there's limitations on ADUs added being used as STRs. Although, if the deed restrictions are enforced, hopefully that might help. But just to flag that issue, which I know you're all aware of. And finally, I would request that you consider enforcement requirements with penalties at both the individual and jurisdiction level for deed restrictions. These, I believe, as others have said, just having these capabilities available for workforce is critical. But I also have heard that deed restrictions aren't particularly well enforced. Maybe that's true, maybe it's not, but having some teeth in that component, I think, might be helpful. And I thank you very much for your time. It's been a wonderful presentation to listen to. Thanks.
Thank you. Appreciate the comments.
Next, we have Philip Gillenfar. If you'd like to go ahead and address the committee. looks like he may have lowered his hand. Yep. Philip, if you want to make a comment, please.
There I go. Sorry about that. I was muted. Sorry about that. Madam Chair, thank you for that. If you hear me, thumbs up.
Yes, you're good.
Staff, really appreciate staff's compiled a great presentation and captured really the challenges we have. It's been many years now we've attempted to develop affordable housing or workforce employee housing and really have run into a lot of brick walls. The primary, of course, is coverage and density. And those are the two primary things. I know that height was discussed, but you know, height is not quite as challenging, but density and coverage really is. The second piece is obviously this is a part of the Nevada portion, and that is that they're really, the jurisdictions of Nevada don't really have the ability to help guide us on deed restrictions and the language proper, because California has a good sense for that, but Nevada has not picked that up. But in order to protect these units, I think we need to kind of come up with some better language that allows those deed restrictions to be incorporated. The other comment I had was there's some plan areas like for instance, Ponte Rosa Ranch, and I'm probably one to blame because I was on the community plan team originally and on the new community plan when the Tahoe area plan was developed. And for whatever reason, that particular plan area doesn't allow employee housing, yet it's walkable to the Hyatt and to the Sierra Nevada College. So I just thought that was an interesting one. We do have a client who has indicated that they would love to incorporate some workforce housing on their property, but of course it's certainly now an industrial zone, so it's not recognized as something that could be done. So I'm hoping that in this discussion and this review, that maybe that's an opportunity to look at some of the plan areas that are adjacent to town centers to see if there's an appropriate way of incorporating housing in those areas if they have proper transportation or walkway, bikeway paths. So that was really all I had. I just wanted to say I really appreciate staff. I feel like this is something that's really been necessary, and I'm glad that that is finally on the forefront, and I'm happy to put together a pilot project. So thank you.
Thank you, Bill. Next, we have Steve Teixeira. Steve, please go ahead. You can address the committee.
Thank you, Maria. Good afternoon, Chair Novosel, members of the committee, Steve Teixeira on behalf of Tahoe Chamber. I too want to offer my commendations to staff and the consultant team that worked on this. This is the level of detail we really need to get into to try to solve these intractable challenges. And I really appreciate the approach that, you know, one size doesn't fit all. And we're going to have to work carefully with the local government partners to see in what areas what things can be done. I think the adjacency to transit is certainly an important consideration, as is areas of large employment. And as Commissioner Hill said, we need functional businesses, and not just functional businesses, but functional public services too. Our local government workers, our utility workers, our first responders. So we need to really get into the level of detail and explore all the options that have been laid out and understand why certain things don't work the way they are presently constituted. And thinking about the environment and the environmental protections, which are, of course, important, we need to consider what are the environmental impacts on Tahoe if we don't provide affordable and achievable workforce housing within the basin itself. So we look forward to continuing our engagement in this process, and thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Steve.
Madam Chair, we have one more hand that's gone up. Sherry Barker, please go ahead and address the committee.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, thank you, Sherry.
Hi, I am Sherry Barker. I am the Nevada Tahoe Resource Team land agent, and I run the land bank for the state of Nevada. And I am wondering, if one of the ideas has been to look at adding possibly a high-rise type community in each county and possibly with a parking garage. And this could accommodate similarly to large hotels and hold a lot of individuals, and as well could possibly make transit easier, could possibly have one bus or shuttle that works with just the each high-rise community. And I guess it's just an idea to help reduce coverage and also to create less building and all the permits that would be required and other items that it does take time, money, and effort and consideration. I guess that's just my comment. Thank you.
Thank you, Sherry. So, Mario, do I take it this out at the end?
We have another one.
Okay.
Gavin Feiger, please go ahead.
Hey, thank you. Good morning. Gavin Feiger on behalf of the League to Save Lake Tahoe. Thanks to Alyssa and Karen and staff for putting this together. And we've been part of the Tahoe Living Working Group since its inception. We've been the only environmental voice consistently taking part. We've definitely been heard and working closely with staff. Really like the direction almost all of this is going. And just a few quick comments for the benefit of everybody listening today. First off, really agree with what Mr. Lawrence had to say about, you know, making sure that anything that's pursued is pursued through the lens of the regional plan and its associated environmental document. There could be some opportunities for trade-offs, as Mr. Friedrich and Ms. Novosel mentioned. You know, we can get into more details through the working group. A few other big picture things. You know, these are all great details. I'm really excited to see some of them move forward. A few big picture things. Can't talk about coverage without talking about parking. I mean, if I said it before, say it again. You know, are we trying to find places for cars or for people to live? I mean, you look at the percentage of coverage that's going to parking, and it just doesn't make sense. And I know it's complicated, but those two things have to be considered together. I really agree with Ms. Aldean that the 20% of, you know, what you could call inclusionary zoning to qualify for density increases is definitely not enough. And finally, I think it is, well, a bit of the outside of the scope of what we're talking about today. Looking back at the decision to allow short-term rentals as a residential use is a big picture thing that really does need to be considered. It would not take the level of environmental review that some of these others would. So that's it for today, and look forward to working with the working group going forward. And I'm sure we'll be back in front of you here in the next couple of months.
Thank you, Gavin. Any other comments, Maria?
Madam Chair, there's no further public comment.
Okay, thank you. Then I'm going to bring this back to the committee. Karen, did you want to comment? I know the one question I heard out of all that was about the slides, if they were going to be available to the public.
Yes, we can make those available.
Okay, so I take it they just go to our website and we'll have that on there somewhere soon.
Yeah, we'll try to do that by the end of the week.
Perfect. Okay, great. Thank you. Any other comments from either our committee members or anyone else here in the room? Seeing none, this was just, we don't need a formal motion. It was just to get a sense from the committee which options that we should pursue. Do you have enough information there, I take it, Alyssa and Karen? Okay, great. Wonderful. All right. Then with that, we're going to go on to item 4B, which is discussion and possible action recommendation of changes to the achievable housing definition, including amendments to Chapter 90 of the TRPA Code of Ordinances. So I think with that, we're going to go back to Karen again. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. In the interest of time, I think I can try to shorten this a little bit. I'm going to assume that people are pretty familiar with how our bonus unit and development rights system works, and I'm just going to go to the changes that we're proposing to our achievable definition. If anybody has questions, you can ask. Okay. So could you advance the slide, please? Maybe one more. Okay, great. So we've been hearing, and I know this came up a little bit at operations this morning, we have been hearing that our achievable deed restriction language is, since it's just income-based, it allows for people who are working remotely for a company outside of the basin to occupy those units. And while it's not to say that, you know, remote workers aren't potentially an important part of our community and our economy, the intent of this program is really to set aside housing to support our local employers. So we have received feedback, and so we started looking at, let's look at putting an employment requirement into our achievable definition for households that make over 120% of area median income. And that's similar to what Cindy brought up, mentioning that that Placer County has recently approved. The city of South Lake Tahoe also has a similar provision that they've recently approved to focus on deed restrictions that are for people that are working locally rather than tied to an income cap. So what we're proposing is to, you can see here our existing achievable definition requires that people just, the household makes less than between 180% or 550% of area median income, and that amount varies with by the county because it's tied to the median home price. We're proposing, if you go to the next slide, we're proposing that if the household makes less than 120% of area median income, so if that's they're classified as affordable or moderate, that we wouldn't put any sort of employment requirement on them because there's a lot of people that are students or on disabilities. We still want to provide housing for them. But if someone makes more than 120% of area median income, we would require that they work 30 hours, or at least one member of the household work 30 hours or more for a local employer, or be a full-time equivalent employee, such as in the case of a teacher. And then we've also added a provision proposed that people who are retirees who have lived in a deed restricted unit for seven years or more would also qualify. So we'd like to get your input on this change. And then we would, once we've finalized the code language on this, we would include it in the next packet to move forward to the governing board, either the next housing amendment package or if another code amendment package is going forward sooner, we would include it with that. So thank you.
Thank you, Karen. That was very succinct, very quick. Appreciate it. Go to committee members, please.
Sure. I strongly support the flexibility in the language. And the third criteria, I just want to make sure I'm clear on. Do you mind putting that back up on the slide? So one of the concerns we had heard when we adopted ours was that people often do buy a retirement home here. And maybe, 30 hours a week for a year or two and then retire and keep that unit from meeting some of our workforce challenges. So that's why we use the 7-year window. Is that the same? That's what you're...
We modeled that after yours. We also observed that Vail had a similar provision.
Right. Originally, we had talked about 5 years and then we went to 7. I think that's really subjective, but the whole concept is there's a lot of people who move from out of the area and say, let's have a retirement home in Tahoe and, 30 hours a week. I'd welcome 30 hours a week right now, by the way, or work, isn't that much. And we could do that for a couple of years. And so I think that was our reasoning. I just wanted to make sure that was consistent. And as I mentioned earlier in the other committee, we did have a chart yesterday showing some sample teacher and executive assistant type salaries, combined incomes, and how our numbers could never keep up with that, especially with housing costs escalating on North Shore. I think it's up over $1 million right now for a home. So there is no affordability for even at 245% unless you have a lot of family assistance or, other income, so other revenue. So anyway, I like these criteria and keeping as flexible as possible. It will come to enforcement. And how we deal with that. And that's going to take what we learned from Vail, Colorado, is annual validations of employment and annual. And then what do you do and how do you enforce it if they're not employed any longer? And that'll get into code enforcement and other legal abilities that the local governments will have to jump in on as well. Anyway, thank you.
Thank you, Cindy. Jim?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm supportive as well. I think we need to take a look at this definition. I appreciate the sort of the background on the 7 years. I was wondering where that came from. So it makes sense because I was on the back of my mind looking at these and we talked about it. It's enforcement's critical and it's always a challenge. But it sounds like there's some lessons learned. And yeah, that situation with the retirees and you know how do you get that? Now I get it. So thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Belinda. Welcome. On Wes.
I'm reluctant to jump in here. I'm a retiree. Or I thought I was.
You're not working 30 hours a week? Come on.
Oh, Lord, I wish I was working just 30 hours a week. No, I shouldn't say that because I love what I'm doing, but I think the rub for me is the fact that on my side of the border, none of this is applicable when you think about it, because ADUs are required in California, and we've had to look at modifying our rules here at TRPA, and we don't have such a rule in the state of Nevada. And I have been working for quite a while trying to get Kale Drive taken care of, and that's another story. But with the hospital expanding and moving into the Nevada side and a large campus, the Lakeside, bless her departed hearts, is quite a large property. And so this is going to confound some of the problems that we're having over there, especially down in the Kale Drive area, if something isn't done on the Nevada side. But I'm not sure what would be acceptable. I know that having moved here 31 years ago, my house was in the threes, 300,000. And now the house next door and across the street, it both hit the market at over $1 million. So, I'm sitting here thinking, well, I'm not going to get anything out of this, but my kids sure as heck will. But they're going to take me out of here in a box. But I'm not sure on the Nevada side what we can do, and I fully support what you're trying to do on the California side.
Okay. Thank you. Go on to online. Shelley, do you have any comments?
More of a question for Karen. I'm a little confused because the whole focus of this exercise is directed at housing for people who are moderate income earners. So that is a given. And so I'm not sure why we're saying that, you know, the achievable income category includes permanent residents who meet at least one of the following criteria. They all have to be moderate income or below. So I think what the options are, you have to be moderate income or below, and at least one occupant has to work at least 30 hours, so on and so forth, or is a retired person who has lived in a deed restricted unit in the basin for 7 years. So the given is that they meet the income requirements. And then we further define, you know, their ability to occupy these units by whether or not they're employed or whether or not they're retired and have lived in the basin for 7 years. So the way I would reword it would be upon, you know, update the definition to limit the achievable income category to include permanent residents who have a household income not in excess of 120% of the respective county area's median income, moderate income households, and below, and at least one of the following criteria. Is that what was intended, or am I misunderstanding the whole intent?
Well, in part because I went quickly through the original slides, I didn't give some of the background, but our achievable category is different than our moderate income category. So we have an affordable income category, and that is for people who make 80% or less of area median income. Then there's a moderate income category, and that's for people who make less than 120% of area median income. But in 2018, as part of the Development Rights Strategic Initiative, the board approved the achievable category, which is for people who make incomes above moderate income, because we're finding that even people who make above moderate income cannot find or afford housing because home prices are so high. So it is, this achievable category is specifically targeted to people who do make more than 120% of area median income. But what we're trying to kind of build into this is that if they make that high, you know, if they make a relatively high income, they also need to be employed by a local employer in order to qualify to live in that housing.
Well, that is a little confusing. I wonder if we could redefine achievable. I mean, I don't. Anyway, it's late. I'll let you wrestle with that, Karen. Anyway, it's just confusing because we lead in with a definition of achievable income category, and then we're talking about moderate income folks. So the other thing is, I think that updating the compliance requirements and the deed restriction template to state the TRPA shall conduct a random audit. This addresses the concern that was expressed by one of the callers that, you know, I think we need to be a little bit more proactive with respect to confirming that everyone who has received these benefits, you know, is adhering to the limitations under the deed restrictions. I think that's it. Anyway, I think it's well done, and it's certainly a good step in the right direction. I appreciate all your hard work. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Shelley. Perhaps you can meet with Karen later time, kind of make sure you hammer that out before we bring it back. Thank you. So with that, I'm going to go to Alexis, please.
I don't have any additional comments. I'm ready to move forward with this. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Then John?
Yeah, just a quick follow-up on Shelley's comment, Karen. Is there any AMI cap for the meeting while meeting the local employee requirement? In other words, could you make $1 million and qualify?
So we have gone back and forth on this a little bit. When we brought this to the Tahoe Living Working Group, we were proposing to maintain those existing achievable income caps and add the local employment requirement. We could do that. We're just finding that the income caps are kind of meaningless, especially as housing prices skyrocket. You know, the income caps just go up and up. And basically, anyone who has enough money to buy a non-deed restricted home is going to do that. And so if someone needs to live in a deed restricted unit, they're going to be the ones that, you know, use those. So we're not really worried about people with really high incomes utilizing these units. That's not in their financial interest. So just kind of for simplicity's sake, and for consistency with Placer County and the city, we are proposing to remove the income cap. But if, you know, we could put that back on if people, you know, feel that that's important.
Yeah. Here, and John, if I could jump in here, sure. The reason is that deed restriction. Why would you not just buy on the regular market, right? And so if you make $1 million, you're just going to try to make as much money as you can on your property. And so you're not going to live with the deed restriction. The deed restriction for Placer County requires you sell it to somebody who also meets those criteria. So it's a built-in cap to how much equity you can grow in that house. And it was we modeled it after the Vail, Colorado program because they found it was working, but it was keeping the increases in value in those homes lower than a competitive market home. So that was the rationale for it.
That all makes sense. And I think that just clarification and discussion was helpful to me, and I'm certainly ready to support this proposal as well.
Wonderful. All right. Thank you. I don't really have any extra comments. I think I've heard a lot of what I had questions or comments on. I do support this. I think this is another giant step towards allowing affordable type housing in our local jurisdictions. And it's so needed. So thank you. So I think with that, we can go to public comment. If everyone else is good, let's go to public comment. Maria, is there any public comment?
Yes, Madam Chair. Okay. We have Carol Black. Carol, if you'd like to go ahead and address the committee.
This is Carol Black. Did you just recognize me? I'm sorry, I was unmuting my phone.
Yes,
and didn't
yes go
see
ahead,
it.
Carol. You're fine. Okay. Go ahead, Carol.
I just have one quick question for you to think about, and maybe I've just missed something here. If I, it wouldn't be me, but if someone were to buy using the higher limit ranges, the achievable ranges, a unit that becomes restricted under this, what you're talking about and proposing, are they allowed to rent it? And I just think about that, and I just, you know, maybe they aren't, I'm not sure, but I'm just wondering what that might throw into the mix, actually for any of these. And if there are restrictions on to whom it could be rented as well. Just a thought.
Thank you, Carol. When we're done with the comments, we'll answer that for you. But the quick answer is no, not short term.
Okay.
I'm sorry, Mario, are there any other?
Yes, next we have Philip Gillenfar.
Thanks, I just wanted to say, Madam Chair, just a quick comment on that. You know, we do have some of these situations where we want to be able to sell these units with the deed restriction, and just want to make sure that we still have that opportunity, because there are people who want to be able to buy them, not just rent them at the affordable level. And I might have missed that, so I just want to make sure that that's still in there.
Thank you, Bill.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, there's no other hands raised for public comment.
All right. Thank you. Then I'm going to bring this back to the committee. Karen, that last question you answer.
Yeah.
I apologize for quickly answering the other one.
Oh, that's great. That's fine. The units can be rented or sold, but the person living in the house has to meet the requirements of the achievable deed restrictions. So you could not rent it as a short-term rental.
Right. That is in there. That's no short-term rentals. All right. Thank you. And any other comments from any other committee members? Either there or online? I don't see any. So with that, I think you were requesting same as before, just some feedback. And it sounds like you've gotten a little bit there. So with that, we're going to go on to item number 5. We're ready? Thank you. Thank you, Karen. And we appreciate all that work. It was a lot of work. On to item number 5, which is committee member comments. Are there any members that would like to make some comments? I see.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just real quick, because I know we're out of time. But this issue, while it is it's extremely important to the Tahoe Basin, and I'm glad we're tackling it, it's also very extremely important to the state of Nevada as well. And just want to point out that Governor Sisolak recently made announcements of affordable housing opportunities and focusing some of the ARPA funds on getting some affordable housing projects done. So it's not just in the basin, but we're also looking at it statewide.
Great news. Thank you. And I don't see any hands raised online. So with that, we're going to move to public interest comments. This is our final matter of business for our general public interest comment period. If any member of the public wishes to address our local governance and housing committee at this time on something on an item not raised here previously, please raise your hand now, either in person or by clicking the raise hand button at the bottom of your Zoom screen, or by dialing *9 on your phone. You will be called on and unmuted by a TRPA staff member. That would be Maria. Maria, are there any public comments?
Madam Chair, there are no public comments.
Wonderful. All right. With that, I'm going to ask a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Thank you. All right. And all those in favor say aye.
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 No opposed? Motion carries. Thank you. Appreciate all the hard work. Thank you again.